taking its time. Okay, now it's working.
I'd like to call this meeting to order. Welcome, everyone, to the July 28th Othello City Council meeting. I'd like to start tonight's meeting with an opening prayer. Johnson's going to lead us. And Gina, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance? Would you all please rise?
Father, we thank you for the many blessings that you have bestowed upon the city, and we ask that you continue to do so, and we ask that you be with us tonight in our decision-making, and that we can help further and better the city with our decisions. And for this, we pray in your name. Amen. Amen.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all. Again, I'd like to welcome everyone here tonight, and we'll move to item 1.3 on our agenda, roll call. All of the city council members are present, save for John Lawless. It was my understanding he was going to be here tonight. He must have got caught at work, so... In fact, here he comes right now. So I'll wait for him to enter the room. John, we'll welcome you. Just got started, so you haven't missed a thing. With that, all of our council and the mayor are here tonight, so let's move to item 1.4 on our agenda, citizen input. And I would ask at this time for any citizen who would like to approach the Othello City Council with any wisdom or request or information, to please raise your hand and be recognized. You'll have 5 minutes to speak. Is there anyone? Okay. Hearing none. We'll move on to item 2 on our agenda, approval of the agenda. This time I'd entertain a motion to approve tonight's agenda.
Make that motion.
Second. Motion has been made and seconded to approve our agenda. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Item number 3 is the consent agenda. I'd entertain a motion to approve our consent agenda for this evening.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Motion made and seconded. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Item number 4 is current business on our agenda. 4.1 refers to a stop grant, and Dave Rim has a presentation and some information for the City Council.
Mayor, Council, thank you for having us here tonight. In January 2014, the Othello Police Department received a stop grant regarding violence against women, formula grant program. This grant is in partnership with Roberta Anderson and out of Grant County. She's the grant coordinator, and she's here to answer any questions about the grant if we have specific information that is needed. The grant provides an avenue of information passed from law enforcement to victims, advocacy councils and programs, and also through the prosecutors. It's the hope with this grant that additional training for officers will be provided here at the Othello Police Department with the grant dollars. The grant doesn't cost us anything except it's some administrative time. I've worked with Spencer and we figured out that flip-flop of time and a way to account for it. It seems to have been working so far pretty good. This is not the first time that we've had this grant. This is the first time that I've brought it before council. And we're to the point with the first part of the grant that we needed to make sure that you're aware of it. And if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to handle it or answer them.
How's the grant implemented in the community?
The grant implemented in the community at first is with some information from Roberta. She's working with the Othello School District, and she's putting out information about date rape and violence.
Okay. Council?
I see that it says that the batch amount for the grant is an administrative function. What does that mean?
That's time that we spent on entering protection orders and court orders into the computer, state computer system. It also for time for some training that I had to do to fulfill the grant request, and then pays for officers' time that they're charged with serving the court papers.
Thank you, Dave. Council? So you recommend that we approve the grant?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'd entertain a motion.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second.
Is there any further discussion about the grant? All those in favor for approving this grant signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The next item on our agenda is a proposal from Paid People Against Illegal Drugs and an ordinance. And Dave, you've spoken to me on a number of occasions about this ordinance that you've been working on.
Yes.
So why don't you inform the council of the issue?
The issue that we have here before you today, council, is that currently Washington state law doesn't provide a bridge between what an officer responds to for an underage drinking party and when we can't reach the level of beyond a reasonable doubt and issue a citation off of RCW. This bridge is a city ordinance. It is a civil violation, so it's a preponderance of evidence, and it just gives another tool to the law enforcement that when they respond to such disruptions of community life, that they have something that they can use. The grant or the ordinance isn't in place in other communities. We're not making case law on this, but the ordinance that we have here is in support of a grant provided by the paid group takes care of the functions of the grant, and this is part of it, so we can continue on with the grant. With me, I have members of the paid group and Amaris Garza, who she is the biggest help as far as the grant goes, and we have a small presentation we'd like to show you. So just some background. PAID is a grassroots organization developed here in Adams County. Its mission, as you can see, is written on the PowerPoint that was given you. The grassroots coalition became in 1985 after a couple of fatality accidents that juveniles were involved in. Since then, it's been involved in the court system, and particularly with the DARE program that we no longer have here in our community. It provided for the DARE program support, bookkeeping, training for the officers, funding for a number of other things. They paid through assistance with the courts, was able to buy the portable breath testers for the Othello School District. So those are the kinds of things that PAID has been involved in. And now we're running into another portion of PAID, and has to do with the social folks ordinance. I'm going to give that to Amaris, and she's going to discuss it.
Well, good evening to you all today. My name is Amaris Garza, like you mentioned. I was raised here in Othello and graduated from Othello High School in 2008. And I went to school at Eastern Washington University for a double major in criminal justice and counseling psychology. And now I'm a prevention specialist for integrated healthcare services. And with that, I'm also a coalition coordinator. So as you guys can see up here, the social host ordinance basically is focusing on a location where underage drinking occurs. And it can be used in conjunction with the RCW, but also an additional tool when there is not that level of evidence. We are focusing on the environment, which targets the environment where use occurs whether it's social, physical, or public. It views substance use or abuse as a general reflection of the community norms, and it empowers local law enforcement to change the environment. So it seeks to change the community as a whole, physically by the location, legally by the level of evidence needed, and the social process by changing the norms and beliefs of our community. Using the social host ordinance to address home parties, why do we care about this setting? It is very important because at these settings, there is a high risk for all the youth. Parties are a high risk setting for binge drinking and the consequences of that. Alcohol is provided at these locations for the most part at these parties, or there is a low cost per drink. Often these parties are unsupervised or with parental permission. At these parties, it increases the risk for many things, such as driving under the influence, riding with drunk drivers, sexual assault, violence, and also injury. So this is why we are really focused on the setting. Some research has showed throughout the U.S. that drinkers, unexperienced drinkers, are introduced to more heavily drinking by other experienced drinkers at these parties. And high school students have reported that the last time they drank 5 or more drinks was at a party that included 11 or more people. So a little bit closer to our home. The 2012 Healthy Youth Survey done in Othello, there was various questions asked to the youth, and one of these questions was if you think alcohol is easy to get. 29% of 8th graders and 52% of 10th graders said yes to this question. It is easy to get. The next part, they asked where they get alcohol, and these were the top 4 answers: at home with parental permission, at a party, from an older sibling, or at a family celebration. The next question I have for you guys from the Healthy Youth Survey is that you think they will not get caught when they drink. 60% of 8th graders and 74% of 10th graders said that they do not think they would get caught if they were to drink. The next one was that youth believe community doesn't think drinking is wrong. When asked how long most adults in your community think it is for kids your age to drink alcohol, youth responded with little wrong or not at all wrong. 14% of 8th graders and 20% of 10th graders. And 17% of 8th graders and 27% of 10th graders said their parents were probably okay with substance use for kids. So our intention with this social host ordinance is to change the community culture and condition overall. We know that there's a lot of people in our community that with their culture comes a rite of passage, so there's an age that kids get to where it's okay, it's normal to drink. To change the focus of underage drinking to the provider and enabler, so whoever's in charge of the location would be held liable under this new ordinance if it's implemented. Decrease furnishing alcohol and due to underage drinking as a whole with the risks that come with it as well. So what is a social host liability? Social host liability is that the law can hold non-commercial individuals liable for these things. So this includes parents, family members, friends, grandparents, personal residences, whether they're rented or owned as well. So types of social host liability. There are 3 types. Civil or tort is when a neighbor is allowed for their parties to sue social hosts for any damage. Criminal is when you can impose criminal sanctions such as fines or imprisonment. But the one that we're focusing on or leaning towards is civil. Civil liability, it treats underage drinking as a public nuisance and a threat to public safety. Affirmative duty is imposed on homeowners to prevent parties from occurring at their home. Imposes civil fines. It includes landowners, tenants, and renters. And the level of evidence for furnishing alcohol is not a requirement under this liability. The advantages of this liability is that there is no acknowledgement requirement. So if someone has a party at your home and there's no knowledge, even if you don't know that this could fall under you unless your child is 16, and we could follow up with questions after I'm done. So fines are imposed through a criminal sanction, so basically the police just has the right to give them a ticket on the scene. And it promotes shifts in the communities and social norms. So how will people know about this if it's implemented? I will leave that to Vicky Goosey. She's our administrator at Integrated Healthcare Services.
Hi, my name is Vicky Goosey, and I'm the administrator of Integrated Healthcare. And with, if this social host ordinance is passed, it's no monetary value, or it will not cost the city any monies. We basically got a grant from the Partnership for Success, and the dollars would come from our agency to support this ordinance. We have allocated $5,000 through September of this year for education. We're intending to purchase billboards and materials to hand out to the community. I've also budgeted $13,000 for next year from October 1st through September 30th of 2015. That $13,000 would help support billboards or any type of educational material that we would be able to put out to help get the information out to the community of what the importance of the social host ordinance would be. So, and then we also, just to continue, the Partnership for Success grant goes for 5 years. So after that, we have 3 more years that I could put into budgeting for this project. So we don't see any dollars coming from the city to help support this ordinance. We just kind of need the passage and support to put it into place, and then our agency can kind of put in the monetary value to continue it on.
So we did get to go to several businesses here in Othello and have them sign a petition in support of this ordinance. And here's just a copy of the petition. And that's all. Thank you for your time. If you guys have any questions, we are able to answer.
That was a presentation from PAVE Coalition, and many members are here tonight. You have the ordinance as it's written, was sent to the council. We'll be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Council?
I have a question.
Basically, the only thing this is going to do is give you the ability to write the homeowner or the property owner a $200 ticket.
Whomever is in control of the location. So it doesn't have to be the homeowner or the
But even if they have no knowledge of it, they still can get a $210 ticket.
It's possible. However, that doesn't take away the discretion of the officer to do the right thing.
But you guys still have a lot of tools in your to break those parties up and control those kids.
Most of the tools that we have are violation of RCW, and the ceiling for evidence is higher in that. That's beyond a reasonable doubt. This is a civil infraction, so it's a preponderance of evidence, which is only 51%.
But that is the only thing that's going to change the business, right? The ability to write that citation.
That's one of the changes, and the other change, I think, would be that it's an infraction right there. It makes it easier to write.
But the parents or the landowner would have to be there to receive that infraction, right?
Under strict liability, no. However, that doesn't take the discretion away from the officer to do a proper investigation to find out who is in control of the residence or the home.
Okay. So if I'm a homeowner renting a house, the ticket would go to the renters first before it would come to the homeowner.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, you have education monies that are available, but it's also contingent upon approval passage of this ordinance.
I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. Basically, these dollars we wouldn't be able to utilize in Othello because we don't have this. They were set aside specifically for the social host ordinance. Through DBHR, which is the Division of Behavioral Health and Substance Abuse. Their wanting us to, you know, this is one of the projects they're wanting us to work on, so they have allowed us to put a budget of dollars to this project. So we will lose them, Othello would lose those dollars, the $5,000 this year if we don't utilize them, and the $13,000 next year. We have to set aside our rental budgets.
Okay.
So a lot of the primary force on this is going to be education then, at the beginning of it, education of the ordinance.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And you said that this is a tested ordinance, it's been in enforcement other places?
It's on the books, I'm not sure how much it's actually been used.
Okay.
I think this is a valuable ordinance and something that we really need to, like I said, this is a continuing problem and it's another, like I said, a tool in your tool chest that you could use to help prevent this.
Education. Especially with the education piece, since we don't have DARE anymore, this brings it back out to the forefront.
Okay, I have a couple questions. Does the, Vicki, to your knowledge, does the county have this ordinance in place?
The county does not have the ordinance at this time.
Excuse me? Do you think you could come to the microphone and answer? Thank you.
Sorry. At this time, the county does not have it in place.
Okay. Catherine, have you reviewed this ordinance?
Yes, and in answer to Gina's question, this will be the first of my jurisdictions to have experimented with the social host ordinance. There are a handful of other jurisdictions statewide that have adopted similar ordinances. One of the questions that I had for the interim chief was what the other jurisdictions' experience has been. And I don't know off the top of my head, not having talked to any of those cities, what their experience has been in enforcing it. But from an enforcement standpoint, this falls under your public nuisance chapter. So you are regulating this just like you would any other public nuisance. So the burden of proof is beyond a preponderance for a civil infraction, and that does make it a little more user-friendly for law enforcement to be able to respond, have that interaction, be given the opportunity to educate those people whether or not an infraction is actually issued. As the chief said, it's up to the individual officer's discretion to some extent to determine whether a civil infraction is appropriate depending on the circumstances when they show up. But it does give you, I think, a key tool to make that first contact in those instances, which law enforcement without this tool wouldn't have. So I don't see any real downside for the city. It will be an interesting venture to see how quickly your population becomes educated. And I think they've already done an outstanding job of planning how they're going to do that.
Thank you. Could you pull the PowerPoint back up again, please? I want to go to the advertising piece, the educational piece. Keep going. Where it shows the little ad, the billboards. Okay, I've got that.
16.
Right there. That middle one caught my eye. If my kid drinks alcohol at your home, you'll be answering to both of us. So, you can come up with all kinds of, you know, excuses at this point. Like, for instance, we go out of town and we let somebody come into our house and feed the cat. They throw a party. We're out of town. We find out about it when we get back to town, or else, knowing that I'm the mayor, police department would probably call me on vacation and let me know what happened. But I'm not only liable for that, I'm also civilly liable, am I not? But is that already true without regard to this ordinance? I guess that's really what I'm asking.
Well, I think the difference with this ordinance is that, you know, if law enforcement's only opportunity to contact people at a suspected party with underage drinking. They've got to have some probable cause to make that contact because they're looking for a criminal violation. So they're looking for knowledge or PC that someone is furnishing alcohol to minors or that there are actually minors on the premises drinking.
Right.
This would give them the opportunity to make contact under a public nuisance context instead of a criminal context. So they would be there looking to basically contact whoever was in control of the property at that time. And that's going to be the interesting, I think, journey for law enforcement because, of course, everybody's...
That would be unknown at the time.
Well, and it's in some cases it may be difficult to track down. The nice thing about the ordinance is that ultimately it is a strict liability for whoever is in legal control of the premises. So whether that's the property owner themselves or the renter, in a rental situation, the property renter has all of the bundle of sticks of property ownership in terms of control. So depending on how far you chase that rabbit down the hole, ultimately you will end up with somebody you can issue a citation to. Whether or not that's the enforcement tool that you want to use is another question. But in the scenario you described, just because you were out of town and whoever was feeding your cats decided to have an underage party doesn't, under your ordinance, exonerate you from the civil liability since the property ultimately is in your control.
And that's if I correct me if I'm wrong, the civil liability that you might be referring to is something that maybe the actors do after the fact?
And so the kids as parents all sue me.
Okay, that's the civil liability on here that's not addressed. The other part of the civil liability is that in that exact scenario, you've given somebody control of the house by going in and feeding your cat.
Right.
That's the person we're after.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it wouldn't come back on the homeowner?
No.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. It's who's in control of the location.
And that would only be determined, actually, through an investigation.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I think I understand better about the no knowledge. That's kind of what was my only concern. I understand what Paige is trying to do, and they're trying to help law enforcement enforce underage drinking laws. And, yeah, thank you very much. Counsel, do you have any other questions? Would you like to take some action tonight on this ordinance?
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion to approve ordinance number 8.68 titled Underage Gatherings.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion made and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much, and thank you, Paige, for attending and being present and working with the city. We'll move on to item 4.3, well number 9 update. And we have an update from Larry Julius and Kevin Lindsay about our current well.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. We wanted to give a brief presentation on status of the drilling of Well 9. It'll include what's been accomplished since we've started drilling, the current drilling depth, what type of geological formations we're going through, what water-bearing zones we've encountered, water quality, water quantity issues, and where do we go from here? What happens when we get down to the target depth from the contract documents that Schneider Well Drilling is working off of. Then we also wanted to talk about if we get to that point and we see an opportunity to keep drilling, possibly to obtain a greater quantity of water, would the council consider giving the mayor and administrator authorization to approve the driller to keep going and then report back to council with the results. So just a few things we wanted to talk about. We included on the agenda memo information about budget. The $2.6 million, according to Spencer, is what's in the Othello 2014 budget for the drilling of the well. equipping the well, which is the pump and motor and wellhouse and all of that, and then the 16-inch water main that will transport the water back to the city's distribution system from the well site. And then the second item there, the construction estimate for drilling well 9, before we had our bid opening, we had estimated it would cost about $533,000 for the drilling portion only. The low bid by Schneider Drilling actually came in at about $418,000. So just as a comparison, we're about $115,000 under what had been budgeted just for that drilling portion. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Kevin Lindsay of GSI Water Solutions, who's the hydrogeologist that's actually been working with the city for quite a few years on a number of wells, knows the aquifer system underneath Othello, has been working with Guama on water information in the area, and also on artificial storage and recovery potentials. And some of you, I think, have met Kevin before. Kevin, if you will. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Council. What I want to do this evening is just take a couple of minutes and talk about the progress on this well, where we're at right now. To kick that off, though, I want to take us back in time. A number of you were not on the council back when this saga started. This thing got planned, or we started to plan what to do on this well 9 several years ago. And that planning is relevant to some decision making that may have to be made over the next few weeks as drilling continues and hopefully concludes on this well. So I'm going to take you back. For those of you who were here, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, you've seen this graphic before. You can watch it and relearn what we talked about then. For those of you who weren't here, I want to kind of explain what this cartoon, this graphic describes, because this is relevant to how we decided to drill it and some of the decisions that might need to be made in the not-too-distant future. So when we are planning this out, this is a geologic cross-section through the city of Othello right there, and I'll try to get both sides so you can all see it, to the west, out to the east of the port of Othello, out at east of town. Right there. And these are as-built diagrams of some existing wells that are in the ground. This thing is drawn to scale, although it is somewhat exaggerated in the vertical direction. This is City Well 6, right there. City Well 8, right there. And Port Well Number 3, right there, far to the east. The black line right there is the position of Well 9. Relative to these other wells. And so I'm just going to basically talk to you about briefly about what each of these wells told us about the conditions out here, and it told us some very interesting things. Well 6. Well 6 originally was a 1,200 or so foot deep well. The lower 200 feet or so of that is now plugged off. But when that well was 1,200 feet deep, you see a couple things. There's some Fs right there and some up-directed arrows. The Fs and the up-directed arrows. There were two things going on in well 6. High fluoride water was being produced into that well near the bottom and moving uphole into shallower zones where it was discharging into shallower parts of the aquifer system. The high fluoride water was above the state regulatory limit, somewhere in the order of 5 milligrams per liter. The regulatory limit is 4, so it was giving the city some challenges on using that well because it exceeded the regulatory limit for fluoride. The well also had the uphole flow, which by reading of WAC 173-160 is really what that well should not do, because it is quote-unquote commingling aquifers or commingling water-bearing zones, and that's ecology doesn't like that, so you know, that needs to be sealed off if possible under certain circumstances. So in well 6, very high quantity producing well prior to the plug that hoped that took care of most of this problem at the bottom. That plug was put in 3 or 4 years ago now, something like that, to get rid of most of this problem at the bottom of the well. But a very high production quantity-wise, unfortunately with very high fluoride, again, fluoride above the regulatory limit. The plug took care of most of that problem. Well number nine over here, well number eight over here, drilled in...
Excuse me?
Yes.
Kevin,
yes.
When you say took care of most of the problem, is there still a problem with fluoride?
There's still some fluoride in that well.
Above the MCL for drinking water standards?
I have to look at the data. I haven't seen the data on it for a while. Is it?
The data, last time I was a couple years ago, some of the results are coming in below four, some slightly above four. The Department of Health allowed the city to perform.
The Department of Health allowed the city to go off of an emergency status to a seasonal status, which means the well can be used at any time, any amount. The thought was that the amount of fluorides wasn't as great as it had been. It can be commingled with other water in the distribution system, and it would not cause a detrimental effect. So health thought that the work that was done was sufficient at the time. We've had no problems with health since then, and they've allowed the city to use the water as we can. I think the last we heard, it was around 2,000 gallons a minute, 1,900, I think, something like that. Is that? Yeah, that's about where we're at right now, 1,900 to 2,000. It originally was around 3,000, but like Kevin said, because of the plug, we took care of most of the fluorides, but we also lost production.
Okay, so City Well 8 drilled in 2002, I think, right there, the schematic for that well. Also hit fluoride in the bottom of that well. That well,
what's the total depth on the bottom of number 8?
Well, number 8's original depth at the time of drilling was 951, thank you, John. 951, the plug was put in at the bottom, currently is at 870. It's a cement grout plug.
How much more room did you have before going to the Grand Ron?
Our estimate would have been another 100 to 200 feet based on the thicknesses of where wells do that in the area.
So when you did your water analysis sampling, you decided to stop because you had fluoride levels, and then you decided to seal that off?
Yes, there's two things that happened.
How much flow were you getting from the bottom of that well?
That was never measured as far as I know. I actually did not work on well 8. I got the cuttings after the fact. There had high fluoride concentrations when they hit this blue highlighted zone right there. More water was produced into the well, fluoride went up. There was a decision made by the people running that project at the time to plug it off, to remove the fluoride problem because it was in excess of the regulatory limit. I do not know what that well produced at the time it happened, although the stories I heard, it was a pretty good producing well, but again, came with a fluoride problem. So, keep in mind where that fluoride is occurring. It's occurring at this horizon right here, which is the top of something we call the Palouse Falls. There's the geologic people that work in the area. It's right there. It's the contact between this orange stuff and this green stuff. It's in, for those of you who like to track the names, it's in the lower part of the Frenchman Springs, member of the Wanapum Basalt. So, we have a problem at that horizon. We have uphole flow and high fluoride. Uphole flow presents a commingling problem in well construction, according to WAC 173-160. The fluoride is a health department problem.
Commingling of two aquifer systems, but you're not in the Grand Ronde.
Correct.
You're just in the Wanapum.
Correct. Ecology reserves the right to call that commingling and could regulate that, could regulate a plug to be put in that well. And a plug was put in that well to remove the commingling, the flow differential in that well. Water was literally flowing in the bottom, uphole, and out into a shallower formation.
Have you seen ecology exercise that right?
I've seen them talk about it. Where have they? I don't know if they've ever actually pulled the trigger. They pull the trigger on downhole flow all the time. That's why casing seal requirements are usually you've got to take that casing and seal deeper because they don't want cascading in. It's the same rationale, only in this case it would be uphill flow. So they threaten it. I don't know if they've ever actually had to carry it out. They've never had to carry it out on a job I've worked on. Okay, so those are wells in town. That's the condition that was going on there. We had to think about that in the design of this well. Then we go on to the port well. Port well number 3, drilled 7 or 8 years ago, completely different conditions. Grand Ronde in this Palouse Falls horizon, significantly shallower. You can see them up here. Over here, they're 300 to 400 deeper, 300 to 400 feet deeper in town. That well was only drilled and constructed into the upper Grand Ronde, a deeper unit, had a 90-foot depth-to-water static level at the time it was drilled, and as far as I know, it's probably still there. I do not know if the port uses that well. I know there's a well house on it. They do use it? Okay, is it still pumped? Excellent. I know when we tested it, it looked very nice. So, very different condition here. Much shallower geologic units, much shallower water-bearing units. I'm not aware that there's a fluoride problem in that well. It's sealed off to all the shallower stuff. That's significantly different than these wells. You notice these two blue lines right here? Static water levels in those two wells over the past couple years on the order of 400 feet below grade. 80 feet below grade over here. So we have a new well that's somewhere between this set of conditions and that set of conditions. And so the planning was all around, what do we plan for? So I'm going to go to the next slide and talk about a couple of things. As these again were, this is refresher for everybody who wasn't here a few years ago. So in this area, we got a couple things going on. We've got deeper geology and hydrogeology, shallower hydrogeology and geology, shallow water levels, deep water levels. Why is that going on? These wells sit on something, it's called a monocline. It's a fold in the basalt aquifer system. Water levels on one side of a monocline, the upgradient side, typically are higher than water levels on the downgradient side, down hydraulic gradient side of a monocline. These wells are on the downside, these wells are on the upside. They look totally different. High, low water levels, high water levels, thinner geology, thicker geology. Where is the new well going to be? One scenario is it's somewhere up on the higher side of this thing and will look more like a port well number 3. We didn't know if that was going to happen, but that's a possibility. The other possibility, it's farther down on this structure, and you can see these blue lines we drew in here. It says the fold looks like this versus the fold looks like that. We don't know where we're going to be. We're on one side or the other of that thing. What we did know is if we're on this side, we probably are going to have an uphole flow problem, and we are likely going to have a fluoride problem at this contact that we've encountered in two other wells that the city owns where that problem occurs. If the well looks more like this, then do we have higher static levels and water production shallower in the hole and not have fluoride and not have uphole flow? Don't know. So we plan to basically case and seal into the ROSA, which is upper one of them, up in here, carry it forward and see what we get based on when do we hit these early units, where do we put casing, and then what do we do as we move ahead. So, where are we today? This is a geologic log and well completion log, a well construction log. I'm not going to go into the details. These are a bunch of the units, different colors. This right here is the casing. Bottom of casing is currently is set and sealed to approximately 407 feet below grade. We picked that depth because where we were at when we made that decision last week or so was we were getting into deeper Wanapum hydrostratigraphy, hydrogeology, deeper Wanapum that probably will produce some water, and we have to make a decision when to case and seal. You want to get as much water as you can get. You want to not seal off all the production. You want to minimize your sealed off production, maximize your accessible production. So given that we are down in this ROSA unit,
We decided it was time to case and seal because we wanted to start targeting this Frenchman Springs stuff, which is where we start seeing water production in this area. What did that do, or where are we now? Okay, here's the well as it stands right now, cased and sealed to 407. Current bottom is 680. Current bottom is 680. This is open hole right here. There's a couple things going on. Static water level in this well is 50 feet below grade. While it's being drilled, the driller reports he makes about 300 to 400 gallons a minute with 20 feet of drawdown during drilling. So static level 50 foot below grade, drawdown is at 70 foot below grade. That's an interesting number. These dashed lines you see right here, these correspond to where the predicted contact was for this horizon. It's a little bit higher in the well. Predicted contact for this horizon, it's a little bit higher. Predicted contact for this horizon, it's a little bit higher, it's quite a bit higher. We know that from the well geology, we know that from the drill cuttings, we're confirming that with the X-ray fluorescence analysis. So right now we're seeing things shallower in the new well than we probably originally anticipated, which we'll see where that takes us. Right now, again, we're at 680. Some decisions need to be made at some point. How much deeper to go? This well is starting to trend and look like the port well. Don't know if it will, I wouldn't predict that. But it has characteristics more suggestive over here than over here. We'll see where that takes us. But we do need to make some decisions in the near future. How much further to go at that open hole? Do we take it down to that Plouse Falls contact? That's the high fluoride contact. If we take it to that contact and we hit high fluoride, decisions will need to be made about, do we seal it and call it a day, back up, plug the bottom, and get out of that high fluoride water? Do we hit high fluoride water? We don't know. Over here we do. Over here we don't know for sure, but the port does not report high fluoride in the deeper part of their well. We don't know where this kind of hash pattern right here. High fluoride here, not high fluoride over here. We don't know if it's here, and we won't know until we get there. Will we have uphole flow in this well? We don't know that either. When this well was drilled, it was drilled mud rotary to that depth. They did not report a circulation problem related to uphole or downhole flow. So we don't think it's over there, but that well wasn't drilled to look for that. We know these two have it. If we have uphole flow and we hit that horizon right there, another decision needs to be made about, do we seal it off? Do we call it a day? Do we drill through it? Do we carry an intermediate casing string deeper? Those are all decisions that will need to be made about what do we want this well to do based on where we hit things, when we hit things.
Is there any difference in north and south?
To the north and south, I don't have any deep wells.
You don't have any data, do you?
Yeah. That's to the south, the next set of deep wells is down along the Saddle Mountains and beyond. There's just not much going on down there. We're in the irrigated
ground. How can you forecast within the mile and a half distance that's between the number 8 and and the new well number 9 that you're going to have fluoride levels?
I'm not forecasting that we are or are not going to have fluoride. I'm telling you, at this horizon, in those two wells, I know we have fluoride.
But you have a gray zone.
I have a gray zone. Those are Fs with question marks. It's there to, do we have it, yes or no? If we have it, it's probably going to be along that contact, but we don't know if it's there.
Well, had you drilled farther down in well number 8, would you have broke through the fluoride?
Don't know. At the time the decision was made, because of uphole flow and unstable, they actually had a lot of collapse problems, as I understand it, in that well. Uphole flow, collapse, high fluoride, the decision was made to TD that hole, plug the bottom 50, 60 feet, and call it a day. Would you have hit high fluoride below it? Don't know. Generally, fluoride content goes up the deeper into the basalt system.
Well, are there any other wells in the area of number 8 that would be representative of what?
Yeah, number 6 which did go deeper than number eight, was producing fluoride throughout the entire lower interval of the well.
Are there any other wells closer to number eight?
Not that deep.
That are not 1,000 feet deep?
None. Well, your well is, but that's your, I don't have, I mean, I know we work for you on that well, but I'm not at liberty to discuss what's in that well. So if you want to bring that data to the table, I would love you to, but I don't have it.
It's a matter of public record. I mean,
not your well.
Sure it is. The drilling logs on record.
The drilling logs do not have the fluoride data on it, as far as I recall. I had a non-disclosure agreement with you guys.
Well, we do inorganic sampling annually,
okay.
Semi-annually, actually, okay. Twice a year, and fluoride levels are well below the MCLs.
Okay.
At 1,000 feet.
Okay.
So.
That's interesting.
So, Kevin, this well, currently as we sit today, is at 680
yes.
feet.
Correct.
Chased down to 407.
Seven. Correct.
And do we have any idea of what the flow is today on the 680 feet?
All the driller can report based on the methods he's using is he's using what is called a flooded reverse drilling method, which under conditions where there's not a lot of water around, he has to introduce water to the well. In this well, he does not have to do that. Based on the configuration and setup he has right now, he's estimating that he produces somewhere between 300 and 400 gallons a minute with 20 feet of drawdown while he's drilling. And that's been fairly constant through that whole open interval. So does that translate to 1,000 gallons a minute with 100 feet of drawdown? I don't know. Do you do a pumping test? But, you know, that's pretty decent numbers. That's 400 gallons at 20 foot of drawdown is 200 gallons per foot. 20 gallons per minute per foot drawdown. Did I do my math right? Which is a pretty good specific capacity. It's not awesome, but it's not bad. I've seen a lot worse wells than that, and the city has a number of those that are far less, much poorer specific capacity than well capacity than what this well appears to be doing right now.
Well, to me, it would make more sense to drill deeper to see if we get more water. If right now it did do 1,000,
right.
That doesn't seem like that would be enough to bring a main line all the way into town with that amount of water. Yes, it's more, but I think, in my opinion, we should try going deeper and getting more capacity.
Right. One of the considerations to keep in mind of that, Steve Snyder, the driller's not here, he did point out to us today on our conference call earlier today, with a 50-foot static, going deeper, that's a better situation than a much deeper static going deeper, because his concern was, much like well 8, going deeper with a low a deep static level, hitting uphole flow, and trying to plug that uphole flow with the much deeper static is a much more difficult drilling problem than what we appear to have right now, which is a much higher static, which would suggest an uphole flow condition may not exist in this well, because it's basically kind of doing it already, in a sense. And so he thinks if he hit a situation at depth, it would probably be an easier fix for him than where we originally thought we might see, which is the well 6 and the well 8 scenarios. We had significant uphole flow, which presented a construction problem, as I recall, in well 8. It took them days and days and days to build that plug because it kept coming apart on them. So I think you actually have that flexibility to go deeper. And if you have the commingling problem, if it manifests, if fluoride manifests, I think your fixes will probably be a little bit easier than what Steve experienced on well 8 when they worked on that 10 years ago, I think.
You know, I think personally, I think we should keep on drilling a little bit deeper. My question is for Larry, though, where are we at with the contract with the driller? Did we have that level? Did we have a level set? Or
The contract documents indicate about 920 feet below ground surface is the depth, the target depth. Based off of prognosis, admittedly, it's a guess. But from other wells, we felt that was, I'm talking to GSI, the target to hit. 920, so they do have a ways to go still. It may be later this week, early next week, before we're down anywhere near there. We do have the bonus that the driller's bid amount was about $115,000 under the estimated amount, which had been budgeted for, so we do have a little room in there. The numbers for additional drilling for the 16-inch open hole, the low bidder, Schneider, has about $183 per foot for drilling. If we go much deeper, we'll have to talk to them as far as, is that number still good? Is it going to be a little more expensive? Because obviously the deeper we go, a little more difficult it's going to be. I think we could stick fairly close to that. If we get down into an area where we need to plug off or pressure grout, you know, that could be upwards of $100,000. We just don't know until we encounter it, which is one of the things we wanted to talk about as far as ability of the mayor and administrator to make that decision if it comes down to it on a timely basis.
Decision point on that fluoride is about 120 feet below us right now based on current projections and trends. So that would be in a couple, 3 days once it gets drilled again and things work. Is that sounds about right, John? Yeah, so we've got a couple, 3 days from now, we'll be down there and we'll see the fluoride there and see what we got to do about it, if anything.
Yeah.
That's my presentation.
So, from the standpoint, I just need to make sure I understand. The original contract amount was for a 920 foot.
929.
And so we're at 680 currently. Mm-hmm. But we're not exactly sure how much water per minute we're getting, or gallons per minute we're getting at the moment without a pump test, is that correct? Is the pump test planned? And when is that planned?
Current plan, as my understanding, is it'll be when the hole's completed, but then we'll be tested to see what it can do on a longer term pumping trend.
Mm-hmm.
You can always do pump tests if you decided to get to that horizon, decided you wanted to check it out production wise. You could pump, you could pull the drill rods and put a temporary pump in and do a pump test and decide, is that good enough or not? I would assume that would be a conversation we may or may not have.
Kevin, I want to go back to something in your presentation.
Sure.
You talked about static water levels and it being at 50 feet.
Yes.
As compared to our other two wells being much...
100.
The static water levels is much deeper.
Yes.
What kind of conclusion should we gather from that?
We talked about that earlier today. Right now, water level wise, geology wise, this well appears to be trending more like the port well than like wells 6 and 8. The water levels are much shallower. We're hitting things earlier. There's actually some of the detailed geology is looking more like the port well than like 6 and 8. I'm not going to jump up and down and say it's going to be just like Port Well number 3, but it's the data is trending in that direction. That's probably a better scenario for you. That's probably a more pumpable well. And it appears to be separated from whatever's going on at Well 6 and Well 8, which is a good thing because Well 8 is having its challenges.
So that's port 3 on
yes,
here.
On the far right.
So port 3's cased all the way down to the Grand Ron.
Yes, it is.
And drilled into the Grand Ron approximately...
150 feet, maybe, something like that, yeah.
And they're not having fluoride problems?
No, apparently not.
Is it a possibility, Larry, will our permit or will ecology allow us to pump from the Grand Ron if that is possible?
That's a very good question. 2 years ago, I would have said unequivocally no. But we're seeing maybe a little bit of a paradigm shift with ecology now.
It's either or, pretty much. Either you're in the wampum or you're in the Grand Ron, but they don't care. They just don't want you mixing them.
Mix the two.
So there's a possibility we can get down through there. I think that's one of those decisions we look at as we go. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different than what we had originally anticipated for this well, mm-hmm. but right now that's sounding like a good thing.
Okay.
There's no way of knowing how far away from the Grand Ron you are until you hit that drainage interbed. And Kevin, in your expert opinion, where do you think you're going to see that?
Right now, based on the thickness and depth trends to the east and the west and what we're seeing in the hole right now, in town I'd say top of Grand Ron is 1,100 feet below grade. At the port, it was 740, 750 feet below grade. We are probably trending somewhere in the area of 900 to 1,000 feet, maybe to the top of Grand Ron.
At that location?
At that location. It's probably going to be shallower than it is in town. Maybe by 100.
So if we set up to drill our full depth at 929 feet, there's a possibility we pass through the Vantage Interbed and tap the top of the Grand Ron.
So we'll be very close.
It could be close. I don't think we'll have to go to 1,000 to hit it. Right now we seem to be looking shallower than I would have anticipated originally.
So if we're not going to hit a new water source, why are we going to drill another 180 feet or 200 feet?
Well, there is, this horizon that goes through wells produces a lot of water. That's our fluoride problem.
Potentially that's where your pressure is and where you're going to get
that. That's at least a water producing horizon there. Well, SIPS is drilled with additional water producing deeper into this ring and the fluids falling in it.
And there could be water production at the base of the Blues Falls. There's some reason to suspect that there. So there are a few more potential horizons that you could drill into that could produce water. We don't know. Yeah. There are wells in the area that do that. And actually in the port well, they drilled through all that encased and sealed because that was a targeted Grand Ron well.
Is there anybody representing Schneider here tonight?
No.
No. Okay. Larry, what's the linear foot cost right now? What was their bid cost for linear foot drilling?
In the 16-inch open hole where they're at now.
And this is with reverse circulation?
Reverse circ was about $183 per foot, vertical foot.
Has anybody looked into changing the drilling methods?
Not at this time, no.
Has anybody looked to see if there would be lesser cost for linear foot of drilling using a different method?
We want the brokers to recommend. Review the specs, review the bids, that method at that cost, what the world did.
It's something certainly we can look at.
No, I know, but there's reasons you do reverse circulation. It's a lower impact type of drilling. You don't have to deal with the water, but let's say you went to a rotary drill,
mm-hmm.
and you wasted a bunch of water, you brought in foam and you foamed the hole. Would there be a lesser cost for rotary drilling?
Normal surf rotary?
Yeah.
You can have a hard time lifting that water.
Yeah.
At the depth that they're drilling at right now, they will have a difficult time lifting that much water, normal circ, because it kind of takes or when they were drilling at 680 feet, they were over 300 PSI to just lift the water in the drill string. Because their injection sub in the reverse drill string.
Right, but in reverse circulation, you're trying to force a whole bunch of cuttings up a small, small tube within the drill pipe.
In normal circ, you'd be blowing up the bottom of your drill string.
Right, and bringing it up your hole.
With a 50-foot static. So you have to lift that whole column out.
So you bring on another compressor.
And then your diesel cost increases as well. But it would just be a more difficult endeavor to drill this deep at normal circ.
Really?
This is a fairly low cost and easy, maybe slower.
Really?
Slower, definitely.
Did anybody explore that with Schneider?
Like I was at,
we weren't part of that conference.
Yes.
But that's in there, the way the contract is.
The way the contract is set up is the reverse circ. It was felt at the time in discussions with GSI that was the best approach once we got into the open hole.
For what reason?
Hole control, stability, circulation, rate of advance. We figured we wouldn't be taking an air hammer too much deeper because it had been able to flood out. So we decided to go down this road. We use it a lot on basalt wells, and it tends to work good. We've also used normal circulation a lot on basalt wells if we got enough air packed with us.
Okay, I'm just looking at alternatives. You know, if we decided to go deeper, could we lessen the cost per linear foot for the drilling to go deeper?
That would be a contract.
We can ask.
I don't know what Steve's costs, how he costs that out.
Okay. Do you have further questions, Sean?
No, I'm good.
Council? Kevin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
A lot of information we wanted to know. This is your first time before your public grilling. So,
we were dealing with 3 years ago.
Yeah. We appreciate you being in attendance and answering our questions. Thank you. Thank you too, Larry. All right, let's move on to item 4.4. Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me.
Yeah.
I'm moving ahead. There is a, in the memo, to have the council authorize the mayor and city administrator to direct the contractor, if necessary, to continue drilling operations in an effort to increase the water production from well number 9 and report the results to council in a timely manner.
And
objection to that?
As I understand that, that's so that they don't have to stop the drilling, wait for us to convene a meeting, and then have to restart, which would cost a lot more money. Correct.
Yeah. And for me to understand, the total depth of the hole is going to be 925 feet at that cost?
At that cost, yeah.
At that cost.
Okay. So we still have $115,000 to play with if we need to go deeper.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Good.
All right, we need to go into the Grand Ronde. It was, what, about 100 feet more?
You had $180-some a linear foot. I don't see that changing.
No.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Somewhere around 80 feet.
Council, I'd entertain a motion.
I move that the council authorize the mayor and the city administrator to direct the contractor, if necessary, to continue the drilling operations in an effort to increase the water production from well number 9 and report the results to council in a timely manner.
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Larry? You're still on. Item 4.2. Kevin, again, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bear with me just a minute. We have some slides also as we go through and talk about different projects.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to find another battery source.
We wanted to give you a brief update on a series of projects that we've been working on with Public Works.
Can you hear in the audience? Can you hear in the audience?
Where'd everybody go?
Larry?
I'm good to go?
You have your agenda handy?
Sorry.
Oh, number 4.4 then. Found it.
Thank you. Sorry about the delay. The first project we wanted to talk about was the 2014 Othello traffic study. And this is a road condition map that you've, I believe you've seen before. We were looking at traffic and how growth impacts traffic on a number of corridors in town, including 14th Avenue, Broadway, 1st Avenue, 7th Avenue, all in the north-south direction, Main, and Scutney, and Juniper in the east-west direction. And we had the company come out and put out traffic counting devices right around the end of May, 1st of June, gathered a lot of data regards what's happening within the system. And one of the items we discovered, these are what's called peak hour charts. And it's basically off of the amount of traffic that we're seeing in a city at various intersections during the day and afternoon. And for example, this one here at Broadway and Lee, the first one, shows that in the morning there's a spike, and in the afternoon there's a spike. And that's pretty typical of most all of the intersections, as you would think. People going to work, people coming from work, or in some instances, if we're near schools, people coming to pick up, drop off kids, things like that. One thing that did surprise us a little bit is the afternoon peak is higher at pretty much every intersection we looked at than the morning peak. Some communities, they're pretty even. Some, the morning peak is higher. Some, the afternoon peak is higher. In Othello's case, the afternoon peak is higher. And that's what's used to look at the next step that we're looking at now. It's called, how does all this traffic rate as far as what's called the level of service? The level of service is the measure of can that particular intersection accommodate the vehicles that are present in the city. And the level of service stretches from level A, which is the best you can have. There's no impediments. Traffic is flowing without coming to a stop. There's no problems at all. Down to level F, which is basically gridlock on I-5 in Seattle on a rainy day when the Seahawks game gets out with an accident and road construction going on. So the worst. Most all of the intersections in town that are what we would consider level A or B, which is really good. There are a few that get down to level C, which is starting to get to where you want to do something so that you don't have that problem. And actually the worst intersection that we found was 14th and Ash. That is, it's not quite bordering on D, but it's a definite C. One of the next items we're going to do is take potential growth, especially along 14th, with residential growth that's going on now and projected in the area, CBHA's proposed healthcare campus, and then come up with numbers that support how much more traffic there's going to be on that street in particular, and determine what happens to that level of service. So if we're right now at a level of service B, and we drop down to a level of service D, we know that there's an impact, and it's a quantifiable impact that we can say to the developer or developers, this is the impact that your growth is going to have on our system, therefore, you're responsible to mitigate. And that mitigative action could be anything from a stop sign, to a traffic signal, to a roundabout, to additional lanes of traffic, pocket turn lanes, so you can relieve traffic turning, a center turn lane, so you don't stop traffic behind you. There's lots of different ways that you can accommodate that. And we should be in the process of completing that in the next week or so. I would imagine by the end of August, we'll have a report ready to come back to staff and council. The next item had to do with the pedestrian facilities and curb ramp inventory. And this is a map that is sideways. And here we go. Rotate clockwise. The green are areas that we have had our staff come out and inventory and check sidewalks in town for not only horizontal but vertical impediments to meet ADA requirements. The kind of purplish color are the areas that we have not been able to get to yet. We are behind schedule on this project. To be honest, it's taken us longer than we had anticipated. We're up to already about 1,000 data points in our spreadsheet that we're putting together that'll have each intersection and what the challenges are at each of those intersections. That's also something that we believe we'll have done by the end of August. And we are finding a number of intersections where there are problems on ramp slopes. Some don't have the truncated domes. Some have the wrong type of catch basin grate. There's different types of grates so that if you are in a wheelchair, your wheels aren't going to have a problem if you roll over the grate. So there's different things like that. We were talking with staff last week about there's a community that has already done a system like this where they've gone through and looked at all of their different potential problems and basically doing the same thing that we're doing. They came up with a number of items also. It's just as we get through it, we'll present it to you and staff and show what each of the intersection challenges are. The next item is the West Moon Street sewer project. And some of you may recall that the city received a CDBG, Community Development Block Grant, to install sanitary sewers for the housing area just south of State Route 26, east of the main canal, west of the railroad tracks. And there's a pumping station and force mains that tie into the city's existing, or actually new sanitary sewer system that ties in up here to an existing main that goes out to the lagoons. And the city was able to obtain funding not only from CDBG but from Adams County Development Council, $50,000 from them and $920,000 from CDBG. Work is complete. The last thing that we're waiting for was a review on approval from the state electrical inspector, which probably will be sometime this week. We are
just that $50,000 that you mentioned, that actually wasn't from the Adams County Development. It was from the Adams County Commissioners, and it was part of the 0.09 money for economic development that the county kicked in.
My apologies. From the county, yeah. And we were able to get that money from them.
Yes.
Currently, we are under budget by about $140,000. not only from the fact that the bids came in under estimate, but we're also under the total amount that was bid. One of the steps that we need to do to finalize the project is have a public hearing because of the funding source, CDBG, which we'll publicize just as soon as we wrap up all the paperwork and bring that to council in probably, maybe not the next meeting, but the meeting after, so we can complete that and then get all the paperwork finished off with the funding agency. There probably will be an audit. That's something that CDBG does. But Tammy down at Public Works has been keeping her records up. The first audit that they did was spotless. They were very appreciative of her efforts. And there is a lot of paperwork when it comes to CDBG funding. So I commend her for the job she's done on that.
Is there no use for the 140 that we can use it for?
We asked, we sat down with Terry and his crew and looked at other areas where we might be able to extend sewer. And the funding agency said if it was not specifically in the scope of work on this application, that we could not use it. So unfortunately, it goes back to CDBG. But that means there's other communities that have a low to moderate income level that can use it as well.
Terry, is there a change order coming out of this?
Yes. There will be a change order coming. We always do one at the end of a project to balance out the numbers. It's a no-cost change order. It'll be actually, in this case, a deductive change order because we're under the bid amount. Anytime you have a pipeline-type project, you're going to have some items that overrun, some underrun the estimates. Sometimes there's a little more pipe that goes in, sometimes there's a little less gravel, that type of an approach. And in this case, the numbers came in such that they were under the amount that was originally estimated in the bid. The next, actually, three projects are two of them are TIB funded projects. Let me back up a second on that, sorry. The first is the reconstruction of 14th Avenue from Cemetery Road down to State Route 26, which the city received a grant from the Transportation Improvement Board, an 80% grant, city with a 20% match. Will also be replacing the water main that's in that street now that is an asbestos cement pipe that's pretty shallow, and anytime you go tearing into the road, if you have a shallow water main, especially the AC, you're asking to have it fall apart on you. So that's been budgeted. The work will be accomplished in 2015. We're in design right now, and we're still on schedule to be able to go to bid right after the first of the year. This is also the street that where substantial growth is going on. There's potential for CBHA with their campus down here, housing development going on right now with Ashwood Notch, potential for development along State Route 26, and potential for development from 14th over to 7th, where Columbia Street would come through if it was constructed. So we're also looking at the impact that this road will have on the property owners. There's been discussions of possibly a roundabout at Scutney and 14th. That's one of the intersections that we're also looking at in the traffic study to see what level of service we're at and what will happen with the future growth. So in the next few months, we'll be sitting down with the property owners as well as staff to go over and review those findings. Right now, the street section that's being looked at for 14th Avenue, and this is a hard one to see, but it has a center turn lane, two travel lanes, and parking on either side of the road with turn pockets. And this would be from Cemetery down to SR 26. One of the things that's being discussed with staff is if we were to narrow this section down and only have two turn lanes, or excuse me, two travel lanes and possibly a center turn lane, could we overlay 14th from Cemetery up to Main and take care of any potential traffic concerns that we'll find out from the traffic study? So there's a few things that may change on that. We'll be in touch with the funding agency to see if that's possible, and we'll keep council apprised of how those discussions go.
You have sidewalks down both sides?
Yes.
Street lamps.
Street lamps? That's still in the budget, yes.
The flower pots and water and all that?
We didn't budget for the pots, but we do have water source available and electricity, yes. But we could, I think...
Not the pots, but actually the water source.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we could probably find some funding in there for a few pots too. I don't know if the funding agency would consider that eligible. They have a fine line between surface restoration and landscaping that sometimes doesn't make sense, but they have a certain percentage of the cost that they'll allow for landscaping.
Okay.
So even if we're restoring existing grass, we don't call it grass restoration, we call it surface restoration, so that's approvable, otherwise they'd consider it landscaping. One of the idiosyncrasies of that funding agency. The other TIB project is the First Avenue overlay. And that's from Main to Spruce. And it will be a strict overlay and some sidewalk repair and curb ramp repair, as well as bringing curb ramps up to ADA requirements. Because of the length and width of First Avenue, we split this into three different sections in anticipation of going back to TIB in future years for the overlaying of the rest of First Avenue. Well, those were the projects that we wanted to bring to you, discuss in a few minutes, what's been going on, where we are, things like that. And if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Council? Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Let's move on to item 4.5 on our agenda, water tower maintenance contract. And Terry, you have a report?
Yes, I do. Good evening, Mayor and Council. Tonight I have with us a guest, John Kitchen with Utility Service Group here, put the bid in for this contract here. As you recall, back in the budget season of 2013, we brought this water tower maintenance capital project and introduced it to into budget retreat. The original plan that we came up with was for a seven-year contract, which is a full maintenance contract. The state doesn't allow for a seven-year. They only allow through regulations a three-year contract. We had to come up with a defined scope of work for a three-year contract. We redefined it, and we still were able to get it under budget. It's what we budgeted for. Some of the benefits were lost, you know, the emergency call-outs and the long-term warranties from having a full maintenance open-end contract. We're only able to rehab two of the three water towers in this three-year contract. It'll be a $3 million and a $1 million. $3 million the first year, $1 million the second year, up in at Lions Park. We went out to bid in May. We only received one proposal back, one bid back, and that was Utility Services. It came within budget, comes with a three-year warranty. This is a three-year contract. Upon approval of the contract, Utility Services plans to start work immediately in order to get the first water tower renovated before winter sets in. For the future, there's a verbiage between water and sewer. And Utility Service Group and MRSC, they're going to work to see if they can't get some of that verbiage changed so that this can go into a full maintenance contract instead of defined scope of work where it's only a 3-year and then you have to go back out to bid, throw out another scope of work, back out to bid. So in hopes that this gets changed, we can roll this right on over and continue this. And our next contract that would come up, we'd go back out, and then we would include the red and white water tower down here at well 4. So I don't have really anything else to say other than we need to get started as soon as possible with the $3 million. But if you have any questions, John or I can answer those.
Can we do without the 3 million gallon tank right now?
No, not really, but we're going to give it a whirl and see what we can come up with. It's probably not the first thing we want to drop on the ground, but it's a start as to what we want to start with. It is hot and water is thin, but there's some other things that we got to do as well before we drop the water.
So that tower is the one that's still in the worst shape.
John, you got the specs on that?
Yeah, I can talk about that. I've heard the two things. The 3 million gallon, the inside coating that was put on there is delaminating severely. If you look at the roof, the coating's actually falling into the water. The 1 million gallon has a coal tar interior, which is an old coating. It's basically a tar interior. It fails differently, it gets pinhole rusting. So between the two tanks, water quality concern, the 3 million is the biggest concern as far as doing first answer your question, yes. And then the other thing you brought up was the hot weather, of course, and you guys need the water. It's gonna take at least a month or more to get permits and stuff through. So by getting this approved, we'll start the process immediately. We'll work with Terry and with obviously what the weather's gonna do, and we'll plan the project accordingly, you know, to what water needs you guys have, so.
So I have to believe that you're going to do the interior and exterior of all three?
The original, this contract for 3 years is going to be the interior and exterior of the two lines, Clark's tanks, the 1 million and 3 million. And we're going to do inspections on the red and white tanks. We're going to do visual inspections and ROV inspections and keep an eye on it.
So when you say exterior, you're going to paint it?
Correct.
Have we given you a design?
There was a scope of work that was put out in the bid, yes. Yep. So it's basically it's going to be a recoat of what's currently on, but we're going to power wash the exterior, and we're going to do a two-coat on the exterior, epoxy and urethane coating.
No artwork?
We can put anything on there you'd like, yes. We've got lots of pictures of things. But at this point, we're scheduling and planning to basically put them back the what's currently on them. But if you wanted to add something, it's not too late at this point.
Othello.
Or how about a community schools contest and see what kid comes up with the best artwork?
Stay tuned on that one.
What's the interior coating going to be?
It'll be epoxy, a two-coat epoxy system.
Okay.
Is that what's on there now?
Coal tar.
Yeah, coal tar on the 1 million and the 3 million. It's an epoxy or top of that. It's a zinc-based primer or something. It's a silver coating. I'm not sure exactly.
More or less, how long does that last? When does it have to be redone?
The
epoxy?
Typically, I mean, 15 years is kind of a standard number I throw out there. I mean, we monitor them. Our company takes care of over 6,000 tanks across the whole United States. We average 12 to 15 years. Some go longer, some go shorter. And that's kind of the thing Terry mentioned, the full service maintenance program. We assume full risk responsibility and we code it when it needs to be done, whether it's year 10, year 15, whatever it is, we would do it at that point. So that's the long-term goal. This 3-year contract is kind of the means to get to there. We're working with the legislators in Washington and the Municipal Research Services Center to get the laws adjusted to allow us to do long-term maintenance. We don't only do tanks, we do well and other things as well under this style of program, but we have to get some laws changed to allow us to do business the way we do across the rest of the country.
Now, sure. And if you're able to get that verbiage changed, am I correct in my recollection that then those full warranties will take effect with, once we get that 7-year program?
Yeah, the intent would be to roll them into a maintenance program.
Exactly.
Okay. So you'll come in and you'll sandblast off the coal tar enamel and then do a two-part epoxy coating?
Correct.
Is it a marine base or like, is it like a pool?
It's an NSF approved. We typically use Tenemix, but we use from Shoreline. We use a lot of different products, but it's an NSF approved for the interior coatings of water tanks. So it's, you know, the AWWA recommended interior coatings.
So you sandblast the inside and the outside?
We're going to, the exterior of the tanks, we check them for adhesion, so we do a crosshatch and an X-drive, and then we put a piece of tape on there to simulate whether the current coating on there is adhering properly. And on both of your tanks, adhesion is excellent. So we're going to go through, we're going to power wash them, and then we're going to put an overcoat on top of them. Any areas that have bare metal or rust currently, we'll hand tool those down, we'll reprime them, and then go over the top of the TIPCO system again.
And my recollection from your original bid was on the $3 million gallon tank. There was some situations on top with the ladders and stuff that were potentially hazardous that you guys were going to correct?
It was on the 1 million gallon, yeah.
It was on the 1 million.
Yeah, there was a rolling ladder on top. There were some safety climbs, but those were actually updated a year and a half ago. Yeah. So there's really no repair work to be done other than the paint on the exterior and interior of the tanks and then the inspections.
Didn't you have to add some additional access ports to it?
We repaired and replaced the vent on top of the 1 million gallon tank. So apparently there wasn't any access that we were adding on that.
Okay.
That's good.
Any further questions, Council? Any other questions of Terry? And Terry, the Public Works Department recommends acceptance of this three-year contract with the Utility Service Group.
Yes, we do.
We do. Thank you.
Thank you.
This time I'd entertain a motion to accept the three-year, to approve the three-year contract with Utility Service Group and the amounts mentioned in the memo.
I'll make that motion.
Second. We have a motion made and second. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, item 4.6, approval of skate park design services contract. Molly, you have some information for us?
I do. Good evening, Mayor and Council. The Council may remember at the June 9th regular Council meeting, the Council approved the staff's ability to enter into contract negotiations with Spawn Ranch Skate Parks, which was the selected design firm to move forward with, given our request for qualifications for design services for the future City of Othello Skate Park. So it's taken, obviously, a little bit to get through the contract revisions. Our city engineer has reviewed it, our attorney, as well as Spawn Ranch's attorney. And in summary, the length of time was kind of devoted to making sure that Spawn Ranch was going to be more or less the general contractor on the construction of the skate park. And so with that, you know, they would ensure that the skate park is being built to their design, which is helpful because we do not have someone on staff that would be able to do that. So with that, we've also added various services from Spawn Ranch to the contract, so the topographic surveys and geological or geotechnical reports and soil reports will also be done by Spawn Ranch. So that kind of alleviates the responsibility from the city and puts that with Spawn Ranch to be able to conduct all those services and to provide us with a design that works with what we have and the land that's there. So with that, the contract has, the total cost to the city for the contract is $30,500. And you can see in the budget on the agenda as well as the attached agreement what that covers. And this is just a very brief overview. So we have the schematic design, the design development, construction documents, construction administration, and also the various surveys, maps, and reports that they will be doing on the land that the skate park will be built on. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the council might have regarding this contract.
Council, do you have questions for Molly? Any comments from the committee? Catherine, you've reviewed this contract?
Yes, several times.
Anything you want to inform the council?
No, I mean, there weren't any real problems in getting the contract negotiated. Most of the issues were simply because we were dealing with an out-of-state entity and they're not familiar with our requirements, so.
Okay.
And one point of note on the budget that the council will notice that they have listed, there's an additional $5,000 fee for insurance to raise their insurance requirements. And that actually was worked out today. It was a miscommunication, so that the Spawn Ranch thought that we wanted them to have $2 million in general commercial liability insurance when we were asking them for an aggregate. So that I don't anticipate that cost will need to be assessed to the city.
Okay. Has there been a site determined for said skate park yet, Molly?
At this point, the council committee, the Council Parks and Recreation Committee, and the skate park interest group have come up with a tentative location. However, there could be reports that maybe say that that's not the proper location. It could cost us more money to build the skate park there. But as of now, tentatively, the skate park is planned to be built between the hockey rink and the big shelter at Lions Park on the north side.
Further questions? Discussion? Okay, thank you very much, Molly.
Thank you. I also wanted to just note that this contract amount is probably, I guess we have never built a skate park before, so, you know, $30,500 does look like a lot, but the city did also receive part of a Tony Hawk Foundation skate park grant for $7,500 to build the future skate park. So that can go towards construction of the skate park. So that's, you know, some monies that the council won't be putting forward to pay for the construction.
So that paragraph above the chart, they will render skate park design services, visit a fellow and the site, meet with staff, city council members, and the skate park interest group, as well as soil and site testing. So they come back and they have a rendering, and what if we don't like it?
That's the beauty of awarding them the design services contract, because we can work with them to be able to work out those glitches,
dislikes,
likes. You know, we can say what we want to add, what we want to replace. And they built a certain amount of visits to Othello in the contract, but that doesn't count any virtual meetings, so whether it's on the phone or over the computer. So that is also, we also have that option in case we need, you know, more time to be able to work out with them. But I anticipate the design process won't take as long, since we've had multiple meetings with the skate park interest group and the Parks and Recreation Committee to be able to kind of really understand what you know, the users, as well as those who are providing the financing to build it are kind of expecting for the skate park. So I don't anticipate that will take that long.
Okay. Thank you, Mom.
So also with this contract, my understanding is they will have somebody on site mm-hmm. during the construction as the general contractor to oversee?
They call it construction administration.
Okay.
It sounds fancy.
So in acting as the construction administrator, are they going to select the contractor?
No, the city will have to go to bid for that, and so we'll have to follow, you know, state bid laws.
So once they provide all of the information that they're providing, mm-hmm. you'll go out to bid for a contractor?
Mm-hmm. And I know this has also been a question kind of why the city didn't go through the design build process, but one thing I have come to understand is that if the city were to have done that, we don't have the freedom to go and choose points we don't like about the design and points we do like. This kind of gives us that freedom to work with the designer, whereas if it were a design build, we would be stuck with whatever design we were given.
Thank you, Molly.
You're welcome.
Well done. Council? At this time, I entertain a motion to approve the skate park design services contract with Spahn Ranch.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you.
Item 4.7, resolution to surplus property. Debbie?
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Going to give this report on behalf of Stan Anderson, who's busy with another project. So listed before you is a resolution that surpluses a lot of various computer equipment. It has 9 laptops, 3 desktops, a printer, and a server. And what we'd like to do is have council surplus the property and allow the staff to look at different possibilities of being able to sell them. And we haven't figured that out yet, but we would like to get them surplus and continue on with the project. And so tonight before you is a resolution for the council to adopt the resolution, whatever I said, to adopt the property as surplus.
Debbie, how is the city normally properly disposed of its computers?
We've used propertyroom.com and sent it over to them. We have a contract with them. They sell it online. We've done our own bids, our own auctions. There may be a possibility of other entities needing some of these computers. I don't know what all he wants to look at.
But tonight before us is just to adopt a resolution to declare these items surplus, correct?
Right.
All right. Thank you, Debbie. Council? I entertain a motion to adopt this resolution to declare surplus property.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Motion's been made second. Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Ordinance amending OMC title. This is item 4.8 on our agenda. Ordinance amending OMC Title III, Revenue and Finance. Spencer?
Thank you very much. As you know, over the last couple of months, we've been looking at the different sections of the OMC, updating them, and making sure that they're up to date with our practices, with legal, making sure they're consistent across across chapters within our code. The most recent chapter that we've been looking at is Title III, the Revenue and Finance chapter. We've looked at this one over the last couple of meetings. We've been looking at some of the changes. At our last meeting, a question was raised about the statute of limitations, 2 years versus 4 years, and what the city can or can't do. So we came away from that meeting. Catherine did a little more research to support the 2 year versus 4 year. It turns out that we do have the right to legally have a 2 year statute of limitations in place. We can actually have a 1 year also. Some other communities have done 1 year. And this is something that's defendable in court. If Catherine, did you want to make a couple of comments about that? The ordinance right before Catherine talks, the ordinance as it's written right now still has the 2 year statute of limitations in place as was presented during your last meeting.
Thank you, Council. One thing that perhaps I could clarify, although for me some of this stuff still is clear as mud, but when you're talking about your utility taxes, you're talking about two different provisions in your Title III code, and I think that's partly where some of the confusion has emanated from. You've got a utility tax which is imposed by your city on businesses which provide utility services in your jurisdiction, whether it's telephone, cable TV, natural gas, electric, your own utilities. That is separate from the use tax that is imposed on consumers of natural gas under the state statute that was referenced at the last meeting. and that is the tax on the consumers of natural gas in your jurisdiction that is collected by Department of Revenue, and that's required by state statute. We have to actually sign an agreement with them where they get 2% of all of the proceeds for their administrative fee off the top. But those funds come to us through Department of Revenue, and those are collected, again, on the consumers, not the distributors of natural gas. So the statute of limitations that we're talking about amending does not apply to the consumers of natural gas under that separate provision. The statute of limitations that we're attempting to shorten or impose is one on your utility providers, and that has no restriction under state law in terms of how short a city can go in imposing a statute of limitations. As you'll recall, the AT&T litigation prompted jurisdictions to be taking a second look at their tax code provisions as it relates to their utility taxes for two reasons. Number one, most of them didn't have a provision in there for a taxpayer, one of those businesses, to challenge either an overpayment or an underpayment. And now we are incorporating a process administratively for them to do that. And the second issue that was being brought to many jurisdictions' attention was the statute of limitations issue, because many jurisdictions simply didn't have a statute of limitations in their code. Some already did, but many did not. And so the recommendation came to the jurisdictions that we need to look at imposing a statute of limitations, because in those instances where we are imposing the tax on the gross annual revenues of the business entity has the exclusive control over those records, and they have to self-report their gross annual income and pay tax based upon that. So the onus, the burden, if you will, of discovering an error should rest with the entity that has possession and control of that information. It's too difficult for our jurisdictions to respond to that, and usually when we do find out there has been a mistake, it's years after the fact. We go along budgeting every year in anticipation of collecting those revenues, so we need to cut off our exposure at some point, and to the extent that we can do that legally, it's my recommendation that you do that. I did a quick look online just to see what other jurisdictions have been doing. And of the codes that are online, there were 51 that have statutes of limitations. Of those, 21 cities have imposed the one-year statute of limitations, 10 have a two-year statute, 13 have a three-year statute, and 7 have the four-year statute of limitations. Pasco is the jurisdiction that recently went through a tax litigation case with a natural gas company, not as a consumer, but as a provider. And in that case, this was just a couple months ago that Division III decided that. In that case, Pasco imposed a one-year statute of limitations, and the natural gas company actually paid its utility tax, thinking it was responsible to pay the tax, but actually the property had never been annexed into the city. And so it was a clear case of a taxpayer actually in error making payment to the jurisdiction, and they sought a refund. And the Court of Appeals expressly upheld their process and denied them a refund. So it has been to the courts. I am comfortable in talking both to the AT&T attorneys representing the city as well as reviewing the case law and the statutes that we are on good, solid footing to consider imposition of our own local statute of limitations. How long is up to the council. I simply inserted 2 years because it wasn't the shortest, it wasn't the longest, but it is up to the council.
Thank you, Catherine. So, the issue of whether we can be more restrictive than the RCW and state law is not really an issue. We can.
Correct, because we're talking apples and oranges.
Second, this source of money that was in question, can Spencer, do you think you could clarify that?
Or $900,000 that was received in 2011. The city received about $900,000 above what it usually receives in a typical year from the Department of Revenue. This is a tax that's paid by the consumer to their provider when they purchase natural gas for their home use. The gas is collected by the provider, paid up to the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue has some calculation or something that they use to then redistribute this tax among the different communities that are owed this money. It turns out that the city of Othello had been underpaid, I would assume, over a couple of years. I'm not entirely sure about that. But that this was discovered by the Department of Revenue and corrected by the Department of Revenue. So they trued up the amount of money that they should have paid us anyway.
And therefore, were citizens and or businesses entitled to this revenue?
This is not a... this isn't a reimbursement that was received by the Department of Revenue or by the city. It was a regular allocation of funds to the city, funds that the city should have received into its utility tax.
Collected by the state?
Yes.
So the state collects it, and then in return, the city gets it back?
It collects it from the businesses.
Percentage of it.
Yeah.
And this goes on every year?
Every month.
Mm-hmm. And the calculations just had not been in her favor, and when it was audited and checked, they found that they owed the city of Othello money.
Yes.
Okay.
And Mayor, if I could add to that just a little bit of history that helps clarify why Department of Revenue has had such an issue with the calculations. In 1986, the federal government deregulated natural gas, and that ended up resulting in companies that purchased natural gas going to jurisdictions that didn't have a utility tax and purchasing it there. So the purchase actually occurred outside their jurisdiction and wouldn't be taxed. And so the cities were losing, as well as the state, a ton of revenue. And so the state in 1990 adopted legislation to fix that. And that's the statute that we're talking about that allowed the jurisdiction to impose the tax on the consumers at the point of use, not the point of purchase. So you would still be capturing those dollars for the natural gas that was consumed in your jurisdiction, regardless of where it was purchased. And so that was challenged in court, and it wasn't until 2010 that the Supreme Court resolved that and reversed the Court of Appeals, actually. So there was a substantial period of time where the law was kind of in flux. And so some jurisdictions were changing to try and meet the Court of Appeals decision. Some were standing fast with the statute and waiting for the Supreme Court. And in the meantime, Department of Revenue was tasked with determining where the natural gas was purchased because they were concerned about there being a double tax. In other words, the jurisdiction where it was purchased would tax it, and the jurisdiction where it was consumed was taxing it. So there was a credit worked in, and that's where we got the difference in the $900,000.
So when a city council member a number of years ago mentioned that that was a windfall and should be refunded to users,
no, that was
an incorrect assumption.
Right. It was a tax that was collected and redistributed in error.
Yeah.
And so they were correcting from Department of Revenue the distribution.
Okay. So what I'm not clear then is what type of by adopting this ordinance in the two-year time frame we're talking about, what, give me an instance of something that would fall under that a citizen would be able to, and or a user would be able to make a claim for a refund.
Well, let's say in AT&T's case, we can take that as an example. So you have a telephone and smartphone provider. And when the federal regulations changed to require or to prevent the telecommunications businesses from taxing the internet and taxing certain activities on your smartphones, AT&T, through an alleged coding error on their part, continued to impose that charge on their customers. Several citizens nationwide joined in a class action and brought a lawsuit against AT&T. And the court, as part of the settlement in that case, told AT&T that they had to go back to all of the jurisdictions to whom they had wrongfully reported the gross annual revenues, deduct out that charge, and recapture those taxes that were paid in error. And so AT&T discovered, when they went looking for this revenue back was that several jurisdictions had short statutes of limitations that prevented them from reaching back and capturing all of those lost revenues. And so they didn't get part of those, which unfortunately for those cities that did not have a statute of limitations meant that AT&T fought that much harder to recapture every dime from them, because under their settlement agreement they had to come up with a certain sum of money to satisfy the class action plaintiffs. We were one of those jurisdictions without a statute of limitations.
And so?
And so we are correcting that now.
Yes. Okay. Council?
So the tighter limitations is in protection of the city funds.
And yes. Mm-hmm. All right.
So are you going to ask us what we'd like to do?
Yes. What would you like to do,
Don? I'd like to take it to 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Like to adopt the ordinance with the one with the change to 1 year?
Yes.
Okay. This time I'd entertain a motion.
I move to accept this ordinance amending OMC Chapter 3 titled Revenue and Finance, including a 1 year statute of limitations.
Second.
We have a motion made and second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Spencer, since you're not finished, we'll move on to item 4.9, ordinance amending the 2014 budget.
Thank you very much. I have before you tonight for your consideration an amendment, changing the an ordinance amending the 2014 budget. Over the last couple of council meetings, the council has wanted to do different things. I've got a list of items here. Allocate $20,000 for the search of a new police chief. Some more dollars for the building and planning department review. We've had a number of items here that have been discussed in council, agreed to in council, but not officially adopted into the budget. So what I wanted to do tonight is to discuss these items and officially include them in the budget. I've met with the Finance Committee to discuss possible funding sources for these different expenses, and I've included those funding sources in the brackets after each one of the items. You can see the first few are all from the general fund. We have pool repairs, $42,200. That's going to come out of the general fund, but it'll be funded through the utility tax dollars, and so it'll be a transfer from the utility tax fund to the general, so then the general fund can move forward with those repairs. That might be the oldest one on this list, actually, those pool repairs. And that was one of the reasons why the Finance Committee wanted to wait until we had so many items on the list, but wait until we were a ways into the year so we could see what the utility tax fund was doing and if this was truly something that we wanted to put to have funded out of the utility tax dollars. There are a couple other items on there being funded from the street, one item being split between the street water and sewer funds, the West Moon Street sewer project. That's the $920,000 federal grant dollars that Larry Julius was talking about a little bit earlier. Those are, this is recognizing the revenue and the expense of those federal dollars. So the bottom line ultimately, there's no effect to the bottom line as far as the city is concerned. You know, we have a couple other, the $4,000 with the Distinguished Young Woman to be funded out of the tourism dollars. The very last item on here is something that wasn't discussed in the finance meeting. This is a $355 transfer from the Main Street Construction Fund, 310. A transfer of $355 from that fund to the street fund. This is a fund that the city established, I believe, in 2009, and this track the funding of the Main Street project a few years ago. We haven't been using that fund. we haven't used it at all for a number of years. And so this will allow us to close that fund out. It'll just make tracking our funds just that much easier. If we're not using it, there's no sense in budgeting and tracking it. This $355, or the dollars from that fund came from a few different sources, the street fund certainly being one of those. And so this would just be returning the $355 back to that fund. With that, there's an attachment that goes through all these changes and what these changes actually look like in the budget in each one of the funds. And with that is the recommendation of the Finance Committee and of staff that we approve this ordinance, or we accept, that Council accepts this ordinance amending the 2014 budget.
Okay. Council, do you have any questions of Spencer? Very well done. Thank you, Spencer. Do we need a motion to accept this budget amendment?
I move to adopt the ordinance amending the 2014 budget.
Second.
Thank you, Mark. Gina? Motion's been made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Spencer. Item number 5, is there any unfinished business to come before the City Council tonight? Item 6, is there any new business to come before the City Council tonight? I would like to make a comment that the Mid Valley Swim Championships went very, very well. I very appreciate the work Molly and the public works staff did, the pool staff, all the parents, the swim team. Excellent event. I think everybody was very had a good time. I do want to extend to Officer Rim and his staff the thank you for the police patrols that were present. You guys did a good job making yourselves known, driving by frequently to, because there was a lot of people staying in the park. I think it was the first time I've seen that many motorhomes parked up along 14 or Hamlet Street for two nights. It was very good. You don't normally get to do that when you come to an athletic event like that. So I think the people really appreciated it, and they cleaned up the park very well. So it was very well done, and I want to thank the staff. Item 7, Council will also receive department heads' June reports. And our last item, 8.1, real estate. I'd like to, Council will now adjourn at 9:02 p.m. for approximately 15 minutes to go into an executive session pursuant to RCW 42.30.1101B to consider the selection of a site of the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase. The executive session is expected to last 15 minutes. No action will be taken during the executive session. No action is expected to be taken after the...
Are we on?
Okay. This time, having no further business before the City Council, I'd like to adjourn the meeting at 9:24 p.m.